Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. One of today's guests, Dr. Robert Lustig, is on a crusade against sugar. He's a pediatric endocrinologist at UCSF, and he says it's not about the calories. Sugar is a poison by itself. Just this month, the World Health Organization proposed cutting its recommended sugar intake from 10 to 5% of daily calories. That would be about 5 teaspoons a day. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that adults in the U.S. currently get 13% of their daily calories from sugar. But for some, that number is much higher. Dr. Lustig believes that this level of sugar consumption is directly causing today's alarming rates of childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. And he thinks some types of sugar, specifically added fructose from corn, should be a regulated substance similar to tobacco and alcohol. But while Lustig calls sugar a poison and supports regulating it, our second guest says regulation is not the answer, education is. Keith Thomas Ayoub, a pediatric nutrition consultant at the Albert Einstein School of Medicine, says families should be able to decide for themselves how to make healthy diet choices rather than impose taxes or restrictions on products in the market. So what do you think? We'll give out the number shortly so you can join our guests. Again, we're joined by Robert Lustig. He's an MD and a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco. He's the director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health. It's called the WATCH program at UCSF. And his YouTube video, Sugar, the Bitter Truth, continues its popularity with the public. I think it's got, what, 3 million views so far?
4.5 million.
And we're also joined by Keith Thomas Ayoub. He has a PhD and is an associate clinical professor at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City, where he also directs the nutrition clinic at the Rose F. Kennedy Children's Evaluation and Rehabilitation Center. And he, for 9 years, was spokesperson for the American Dietetic Association. And I'm going to give out the number in just a minute. But first, Robert, why don't you start us off? What do we mean when we say sugar? I think you say in your YouTube talk that there are 56 names for sugar.
Indeed.
It's kind of a catch-all word, but there are different kinds. And you say that they're not created equal. So explain to us, maybe start with the difference between glucose and fructose.
Right. And Let's be very honest here. And when I talk about sugar for the rest of this hour, I am talking very specifically about the sweet stuff. That is, dietary sugar, the refined crystals and or high fructose corn syrup and or honey, agave, and maple syrup. I'm not talking about the sugar that raises your blood sugar, which is glucose, and that's found in starch, that's found in bread, rice, pasta, potatoes. That's a separate issue, and we can talk about that as well. But when I'm talking about sugar, I'm talking about dietary sugar, and I'm talking about added sugar. I'm not talking about the sugar in fruit. I'm talking about what the food industry specifically adds to our food supply, specifically for their own purposes, not for ours. And of the 600,000 food items that are currently in the American grocery store, 77% of them have sugar added to them by the food industry. And this is not just the stuff that you would normally think of, like, for instance, soda and ice cream and candy, but in fact, things that you didn't even know had sugar. For instance, yogurt, salad dressing, barbecue sauce, hamburger buns, hamburger meat for that matter. And as you just mentioned, there are 56 different names for sugar on the label. So they do that on purpose because that way they can put it further down on the label because the label lists the different ingredients by mass. So a different sugar can be number 5, number 6, number 7, number 8, number 9. And when you add it up, it's number 1. And this is a practice that the food industry specifically uses, specifically to deceive the American public.
And Keith Thomas, is there anything that you want to add about the nuances between the different kinds of sugars?
Well, there are. I agree with Dr. Lustig in that there are a ton of different names for sugar, and you know, it comes in many, many different forms. The bulk of what I think are the biggest problems, though. Actually, I should say that according to the federal government's data, we're actually eating less sugar than we used to, and that's, we're talking about added sugars. You know, so I think there's some good news on the horizon. Certainly nobody wants people overdosing on sugar. and it is added for a lot of properties. It has structural properties, all that kind of stuff. The bulk of our added sugars comes in beverages. So we need to keep that in mind. The amounts that are added to things like, you know, tomato sauce or something like that are, frankly, of little practical use to me. I focus on things that are much bigger and much more likely to cause problems.
Well, and let's just talk just a little bit more about the effect and kind of the science here. Can you talk, Robert, about what the sugar is doing to us? What your real concern is? You go so far as to call it a poison.
First of all, I would disagree with Dr. Ayoub that the sugar in the other products is not of consequence. The fact of the matter is that the American Heart Association says that we should be cutting back our consumption to 6 teaspoons of added sugar per day for women, 9 teaspoons of added sugar per day for men, and 4 teaspoons of added sugar per day for children. Well, the fact of the matter is that a standard serving of tomato sauce has 4 teaspoons of added sugar. So children are at their allotment just by having spaghetti and meatballs.
Okay, so, but Robert, we'll get into the debate in a minute. Let me just try to understand a little bit of what you're trying to explain to us about what the effect is. Why are you calling sugar a poison?
Sugar, dietary sugar, that is the molecule fructose, the sweet molecule in sugar, has 3 properties that its sister glucose does not have. And let me go through each of them so you understand. Glucose is metabolized by every cell, every organ in the body. So when you consume glucose, it goes everywhere. Only 20% of the glucose load hits the liver. Conversely, fructose only is metabolized by the liver, so 100% of a fructose load reaches the liver. In addition, glucose goes in the liver to a storage form called glycogen or liver starch, which is non-toxic and a perfectly good place for sugar to go, for glucose to go, because that's what marathoners do when they carb load before a race. And so that gives them energy that they can access easily. The problem is fructose does not go to glycogen. Fructose goes down to the mitochondria, the energy-burning factories inside cells. And the mitochondria, when overwhelmed by the glut that comes from even a soda, has no choice but to take the excess and turn it into liver fat. And that liver fat then has one of 2 fates. It can either be exported out of the liver as triglyceride, which can then cause cardiovascular disease and or obesity, or it can get stuck in the liver and cause what's known as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which drives all of the other chronic metabolic diseases, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cancer, dementia, hypertension, etc. That's one thing that fructose does. The second thing it does is it works on the brain and tells the brain to up the reward. And so you end up consuming more than you ever intended.
And so it's addictive.
It is addictive in animals, slam dunk in animals. In humans, there's still some question as to whether it's addictive. It is certainly abused. We can all agree on. And then the third thing is the fact that fructose is 7 times more likely than glucose to bind to proteins inside your cells and start the cellular aging reaction. This is why we paint barbecue sauce on our ribs before we put them on the grill. This is why bananas brown. It's called the Maillard or the browning reaction. And when that browning reaction occurs, the proteins become less flexible, which means metabolic dysfunction, and it releases little hydrogen peroxides, which damage the cells and ultimately cause cell aging and cell death, driving chronic metabolic disease. And fructose does it 7 times faster than glucose. You add those 3 things up, and you've got a vicious cycle of consumption and disease that is not what we see with glucose consumption.
And that's Dr. Robert Lustig. He's professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco. We're also joined by nutritionist and associate professor Keith Thomas Ayoub, who's associate clinical professor at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Krinen, and I want to invite listeners to join our conversation about sugar and its health effects and whether or not it should be regulated. The number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. How much sugar do you consume? What kinds? Do you know the difference between all of the types of sugars on food nutrition labels? And do you think that sugar is addictive? Have you seen evidence of that in your own life or in your kids? Again, our number to join the conversation on your call is 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. You can also post comments and information at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. All right, so here's one question that I'd like to have both of you weigh in on, and that
I'd like to weigh in on a few things, too. But
go ahead.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, it's very nice to listen to Dr. Lustig, but I really would like to chime in here a little bit.
Okay, that's Keith Thomas Ayoub, and
yes.
Go ahead. And then I've got a question for you.
I mean, listening to Dr. Lustig, we actually probably do agree on some things. I think people do, and I think it's clear people eat too much sugar. Where I think we probably disagree is that I don't quite think the sky is falling just yet. Sugar is not a new food. It's been around for a long time, and it's been in food and beverages for many, many years, long before we actually had an obesity crisis. Now, he spoke a lot about fructose, which is basically half of your table sugar. And fructose is the primary, it's called fructose because it's primarily found in fruit. Now, nobody's, and even he said, we're not talking about the sugar that's intrinsically present in fresh fruit, but that's fructose as well. In terms of what he mentioned about fructose causing non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, Holly, you have to eat a lot of fructose before that happens. So I think I don't want the listeners to think that the sky is falling. There's a way to do this, and I don't think it's the way is through legislation. The way is through balance, and we need to do a lot more work. Plus, we cannot have this conversation without also having a concomitant conversation about increasing people's physical activity levels, because that is a game changer metabolically.
And let me ask Robert, we've got a ton of callers on the line, and we'll get to you as soon as we can. But Robert, the idea that maybe that what Keith was saying is, let's focus on these high sugar products. Let's focus on behavior and changing that, on education. Do you think that there's a danger that you're potentially being too alarmist by including everything as opposed to going after the top, high fructose corn syrup, soda, et cetera, those kinds of sweets that may be the most dangerous?
Well, look, Dr. Ayoub just sort of laid out the argument on the other side, and I'll sum it up in a simple statement. A calorie is a calorie. That is, it's about energy balance. It's about how much you eat versus how much you burn. If you eat more than you burn, you will gain weight. If you eat less than you burn, you will lose weight. This is the standard mantra.
Not true.
Well, this is the standard mantra of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which you are a spokesperson for.
No, I'm not, actually. I was for a while. I am not now. By the way, I should say I was also a volunteer spokesperson. Nobody paid me to say anything there on their behalf. But I think, the idea of a calorie is a calorie, that's under some concern right now. And I think, to me, when you have a diet that's increasingly high in sugar, what I get concerned about is that it's lower in other things that we need. And if we get concentrated on people eating more of what a good diet is supposed to include, there's going to be a lot less room for sugar.
Can I ask both of you this? Do you agree? I'd like to kind of understand what you agree on before we get into so many disagreements. But do you both agree that we have a public health crisis to some extent?
I think so. I think the data is very clear on the fact that we have an amazing public health crisis. In fact, we have Medicare will be broke by the year 2026 if we do nothing. Let's go back to the last public health crisis we had. HIV. 1979, patient zero. 1981, the term AIDS gets coined. 1984, Montagnier and Gallo discover the virus. 1986, our Surgeon General, C. Everett Koop, says, we've got a problem. What day, what moment did HIV become a public health crisis? 1991.
Can we just get back to sugar?
Yeah, well, I'm just going to make a point here.
So
it became a crisis when Magic Johnson declared that he had HIV. And everyone said, oh, my God, this could happen to anyone. Everyone is at risk. Now, Dr. Ayoub said that sugar is not specifically causative of the obesity epidemic, and I completely agree. In fact, I have never said that. What I have said is that fructose is uniquely causative of the chronic metabolic disease epidemic. That is, all of those diseases that travel with obesity. In fact, 20% of obese people are metabolically normal, whereas 40% of normal weight people have the same chronic metabolic diseases as the obese. They get those same diseases. They get type 2 diabetes. They get hypertension. They get dyslipidemia. They get cardiovascular disease. They get cancer. They get dementia. The fact is, it can't be about behavior because normal weight people get it too.
Okay.
It's got to be an exposure.
All right. So Dr. Lustig is definitely comes down on the side of this is a public health crisis and we need to treat it as such. Keith Thomas Ayoub, do you agree?
I think we have a public health crisis, but it has to go far beyond sugar. And again, as I say, we can't have this conversation unless we talk about physical activity, too, because that's also changed. And when it comes to normal weight people having these issues, normal weight inactive people have these issues. Normal weight, physically active people are far less likely. We can't have the conversation unless we talk about people's physical activity level.
Well, why can't we? Sure we could.
Well, I think because I think that's such a game changer, and that's a big, big equalizer.
I mean, it seems like an important thing potentially to bring in.
Much differently when they are physically active. And I'll tell you where I would come down on the side of legislation. I would love to come down on the side of legislation that mandates physical activity in schools, grades 1 through 12, because I grew up in San Francisco and in the Bay Area, and we had it when I was a kid. We absolutely had it. It was at least 30 minutes a day. I don't remember the exact term, but it was grades 1 through 12, and even your first two of your first four semesters in college if you went to a state university. Bravo for that, and I don't know what happened to it, but it needs to come back. And we didn't have the obesity crisis that we did there. We also, I remember a sugar bowl on the table in our house, and we used it. Didn't become a problem. But when you have no physical activity and our lifestyle and our culture today allows us to conduct our entire lives from bed, not even from home, but from bed, that's just a bad thing. Metabolically, that's a disaster.
Robert, you talked about Magic Johnson being a game changer in the last public health crisis with HIV. What about Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign? Is that a game changer?
The fact of the matter is, well, first of all, let me just agree with Dr. Ayoub. I totally agree that physical activity is absolutely required. The question is why? What does physical activity do? Does it cause weight loss? Not at all. There are absolutely no studies in the entire world's literature that show that physical activity alone causes weight loss. What does physical activity do? It increases muscle, causes muscle gain, and muscles have mitochondria. And so when you have extra mitochondria, you burn energy at a faster and better rate, which then takes the onus off the liver, prevents those chronic metabolic diseases from occurring because the liver doesn't get overloaded. So I totally agree with physical activity. Just know what physical activity is for.
Great. Okay, so we've got some agreement there. We'll get into other questions around regulation, but first let's go to a caller. Let's go to Rajiv in San Francisco. Hi, Rajiv. Welcome to your call.
Hi.
Hi.
You mentioned earlier in the show that the WHO recommends about 5 teaspoons of dietary sugar a day, and you mentioned some other cancer organization recommends 4 teaspoons. I guess my question was, at those levels, do you consider it to be safe and healthy? Or is dietary sugar considered unsafe at any level?
My point is that, like any toxin, there is a threshold, is a dose-responsive threshold. Even for cyanide, even for ricin and sarin gas, there's a threshold. It's extremely low, but every toxin has a dose-responsive threshold. Paracelsus said it best in 1537, the dose determines the poison. There's nothing that sugar, dietary sugar, does other than provide energy. It does not provide nutrition. There is no biochemical reaction in the body that requires dietary fructose. So I can't say that it's good or healthy for you. What I can say is that there is a dosage below which it will not be unhealthy for you. So can you get below 5 teaspoons a day and be perfectly fine? The answer is absolutely yes.
All right, let's go.
I would agree. I mean, but the point is that necessary? People have to sort of live, and if you use sugar wisely and you keep it under, you know, reasonable levels, then it shouldn't be a problem for most people. The question is where that falls. And the truth is, even with that the World Health Organization limits, I mean, they really didn't recommend 5% of calories. They said 10%, but you may have additional evidence. You may have additional benefits if you bring that down to 5%. But the evidence on which that is based by the authors of those studies is kind of limited.
I'm wondering.
Actually, it was based on dental caries. And for dental caries, the data is
cavities.
For cavities. The problem is, and Dr. Ayoub will
There was a body weight study as well.
The bottom line is that in America, our current consumption is at 16% of calories as sugar. So we are way over both the AHA and the World Health Organization thresholds. The question
absolutely
is,
agreed.
How
absolutely
do you,
agreed.
The question is, how do you bring that down when 600,000 food items, 80% of them have added sugar?
Well,
that's the question.
Can you tell me just a little bit about the history of high fructose corn syrup? I read that it was invented in Japan in 1966 and introduced to the U.S. in 1975. How did it become so popular and including subsidized?
Exactly. So this actually, during the late 1970s, the food industry was actually a little reticent to use it. And I actually spoke with one of the scientists at the flavor company Firmenich, and they said, you know, we know there's something different about this, but we can't put our finger on it. And the beverage industry, including Coca-Cola, did not embrace high fructose corn syrup when it first came out, and consumption was actually relatively sparse during the late 1970s. And then, in 1980, came the third worst hurricane in American history, and it didn't even hit our shores. Everybody knows Katrina and Sandy. The fact is that Hurricane Allen wiped out the entire Caribbean sugar crop, and the food industry went ballistic. They said, oh my God, we need a sugar source that's homegrown that we have control over. And so they started adopting high fructose corn syrup as its sweetener because, number one, corn was subsidized. Number two, it was homegrown. Number three, they could control it. And by 1985, we had made the conversion, and many of your older listeners will remember New Coke, which came out in 1985, that was the conversion to high fructose corn syrup. In fact, we revolted as consumers, and they had to bring back Coke Classic. Well, you notice there's no Coke Classic anymore. They basically slid it in under the wire.
It's in Mexico, right?
Yeah, it is in Mexico. And Mexico, by the way, has increased soda consumption about tenfold, and that's why they ended up having to pass a soda tax.
And now they beat us in obesity. Mexico is
absolutely
number one in the world for obesity.
Absolutely. So they've recognized that regulation is also necessary. So I would argue that with Dr. Ayoub, that education alone cannot solve any substance of abuse. It didn't solve any of the substances of abuse that Nancy Reagan railed against. We all still have them. The bottom line is the only thing that works is reducing availability.
Well, I'll tell you, I think also what education alone doesn't always change behavior, but education with motivation and culture change do change behavior. Now, I never thought I would see the day when soda companies would be advertising that their products had real cane sugar. Well, the truth is, consumers seem to like that idea. They seem to not like high fructose corn syrup, but the fact is, regular cane sugar is 50% fructose. High fructose corn syrup is 55% fructose. Nutritionally and calorically, they're just not that much different. There's not that much difference in the fructose content. So I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is that we're drinking too much soda in general.
Oh, I don't argue that. We are.
And we'll get back to some of these arguments in a minute. We're going to take a short break. We're speaking about the health effects of sugar and asking whether it should be regulated. We're speaking with Keith Thomas Ayoub, who's a nutritionist and associate professor of clinical and in the Department of Pediatrics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and Dr. Robert Lustig, who's professor of pediatrics at UCSF and director of the weight assessment for teen and childhood health at UCSF. Is sugar addicted? Are all sugars created equal? And how do we mitigate the negative health effects? We'll be taking your calls in just a minute. The number is 866-798-TALK. You can also post comments at yourcallradio.org, and there's more information there. I'm Holly Kernan, and we'll be right back after this short break.
I want a little sugar in my bowl.
This is your call on local public radio KALW to join in today's conversation. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Toll-free 866-798-TALK. You can also just send us an email if you'd prefer to write rather than call. The email inbox is feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can simply leave a comment on that website, yourcallradio.org.
Maybe I can fix things up
so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow's our weekly media roundtable. We'll speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we're talking about what sugar is doing to our bodies and whether or not it should be regulated like tobacco or alcohol. We're speaking with Keith Thomas Ayoub, who is a PhD and associate clinical professor at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City, and Dr. Robert Lustig, who's an MD and professor of pediatrics at UCSF. And we have so many people who want to join this conversation with the two of you. Let's go to Mariah in Oakland. Hi, Mariah.
Hi. I love your show. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Thanks for joining us.
You know, I was watching a presentation, The Grain Brain, recently, and it helped me make the decision to start to limit my sugar. And I found it to be extremely difficult. And I feel myself to be quite addicted. Around 2 o'clock every day, my body is absolutely craving the sugar that I was just not even aware that I was consuming. And now that I'm looking at labels, I'm shocked to find out that things that I thought were healthy are actually, you know, high in the ingredient list is evaporated cane juice. If I consume even a small amount, I notice myself wanting sugar again that same day. So I'm really struggling with it, and it's been illuminating.
Well, can both of you, Robert and Keith, talk about the addictive nature and what advice you have for those of us who may feel the same as Mariah?
Right. I have likened the effects of sugar to those of alcohol several times, both metabolically and hedonically in terms of how the brain responds to it. The fact is 39% of Americans are teetotalers. Okay, not exposed to alcohol whatsoever, and they do just fine. There's no purpose to alcohol other than enjoyment and pleasure, and that's okay, and I imbibe too. 20%, though, of America is alcohol addicted. So that means that 41% of Americans can pick it up and put it down and pick it up and put it down, and there seems to be no specific problem. But that 20%, they've got a problem. Now, the question is the same thing true for sugar? We don't have the data on that, but at least anecdotal and indirect evidence suggests that that is indeed the case, that about 20% of America is addicted to sugar. The question is, what are you going to do for them? No amount of education has solved any substance of abuse. Are you going to help that 20% in any way, shape, or form? And if the answer is education only, and I repeat only, you're not going to be able to solve it. I agree with education. I think education is absolutely necessary, but it's not sufficient. We have needed both personal and societal intervention for every substance of abuse, rehab and laws.
And let's hear from Keith Thomas, AU.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I kind of have to dial the timeline backwards and say, okay, what happened 50 years ago, because this stuff isn't new. It's been around for a long, long time. And we do have a preference for sweetness. That's been demonstrated in infants only a few days old. You know, so we do have a preference, and it probably evolved, I mean, frankly, because things that are sweet in nature tend to not be poisonous.
Correct.
You know, that's not universally true, but I mean, there is probably a reason that we do gravitate towards sweetness. But if there are people who are, find themselves really drawn to sweetness and to excess, then education is part of it. So is motivation and culture. And you understand everybody's got something to deal with. That becomes something that they have to deal with anytime there's an excess. But does that mean that we need to legislate it? Because you can really start under a slippery slope there. How do you legislate? I mean, you've got plenty of really good evidence for legislating that or outlawing people from having more than 2 drinks for a man and 1 drink from a woman. That's what the government says is moderate drinking. Anything to excess is excessive drinking. Now, there's plenty of evidence to show that that would probably cut back on drunk driving, et cetera. And you know what? Frankly, for me, it wouldn't bother me at all. I don't drink that much anyway. So to me, it wouldn't bother me. But is that where we really want to go?
Well,
are there better ways to do this?
Robert, let's get into this. What exactly you are calling for regulation? Can you specifically say what it is that you think should be done?
Sure, absolutely. with respect to tobacco, we have changed our perception of tobacco from fashion to filthy habit in the span of 30 years. The question is, what did that? And the answer is litigation did that.
But it wasn't entirely litigation. There
litigation
was a big public. There was a big public health campaign. I lived through this.
Right.
I watched it.
Absolutely,
and that was a big
start.
Piece of it. And the same with litter. I watched the public health campaign. Absolutely, have a big difference in how we behave.
Totally
and
agree.
Let's not forget that we are reducing our consumption of sugar. It's gone down, according to government data, it's gone down about 11 pounds in the last 10, 15 years. So
I totally agree.
Down.
All right, so Robert, let me get...
I have no doubt that it's actually going to come down further, because I think the society and the culture are changing.
Let's be honest about the reduction. Yes, I agree. Sugar consumption has come down 8% as we have switched from sugar to diet soda. No argument. Coca-Cola themselves say that 42% of all of the soft drinks that they sell now in America are diet instead of whole calorie. So there's no question.
All right, guys.
Let me finish.
Gentlemen, I'm going to pull your volumes down for one moment. I want to get to more calls here, and if you just keep talking over each other, we're not going to be able to do that. Robert, I'd like you to answer my specific question, which is, what regulations specifically are you asking for?
Okay. The very first thing that has to happen is we need a dietary reference intake for sugar here in America. Now, the World Health Organization proposed 5% of calories. We need an amount that goes on the label so that people can actually determine what amount of sugar is too much. Now, if you look at the label today, and it looks and there's a line for total sugars, not added, but total sugars, the percent, the number next to it is there is no number. It's absent.
So more accurate labeling.
Well, not just more accurate label, but an actual upper threshold.
Okay,
The FDA says that there's minima, but they don't say that there are maxima. We need a maximum amount. Second thing that we need, I think that we need to actually determine whether or not fructose belongs on the GRAS or generally recognized as safe list. That, in order to be on that GRAS list, you have to be using amounts that are for intended use. What we intended to use in 1958 when it went on the GRAS list is not what we are using today, and that needs to be rethought.
I don't know what a GRAS list is.
This is a list of substances that the food industry can put in our food with impunity. It started out with 180 items in 1958. We are up to 10,000 items, and of those 10,000, 3,000 aren't even known by the FDA.
All right, so what else are you calling for? Very briefly, please.
Okay. Well, I think that in order to actually reduce availability, we're going to have to do something specific, and the cheap, easy, low-hanging fruit idea is that of taxation. You've seen it now in Mexico. Even Credit Suisse, an international investment bank, has called for sugar taxation as the only rational and effective means for reducing type 2 diabetes and obesity. This was in their report in September 2013.
All right. You're saying, Keith, that you don't think regulation is the way. What's your alternative proposal? You did say you thought exercise should be mandated for children.
Well, I think, first of all, to start young, I think there's no reason that people should. I mean, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends at least 60 minutes of activity, physical activity for kids, not structured sports necessarily, but just physically active, age-appropriate play, and that's every day of the week. So I think to me, if you put that back, we're not even talking about legislating, but really returning physical activity to the curriculum in schools, grades 1 through 12, I think we have made a monumental leap. Also, emphasizing that as many, you know, we have so many screens to look at. American Academy of Pediatrics also recommends limiting screen time. So not just doing more physical activity, but doing less sedentary activity. There's a limit to how much technology can actually help us out.
Wait, so you're saying that's going to help with sugar intake?
It's absolutely going to help with obesity, and that's a big
All right, I'm going to go to more
calls. Because I'll tell you the truth, sugar alone is just not going to solve our health problems and our obesity crisis.
I agree. It's not sugar alone, but sugar is the fulcrum to get us to real food.
No,
real
calories
food
are the focus
issue.
Here. Calories
I disagree.
Focus.
I disagree. The caloric quality dictates the quantity, and we've actually shown that in research studies that if you provide calories that don't induce insulin resistance, your total caloric consumption goes down. The reduction in caloric consumption will occur because we will consume real food in the future.
And I'm going to let you guys disagree on that one. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about sugar's effects on our health and whether or not it should be regulated, whether we should do a public health campaign to help Americans consume less sugar. And let's go to Tanya in Mill Valley. Welcome to Your Call, Tanya.
Hi, I'm calling. I mean, you guys have gone over a lot of what I want to say, but there's, you know, with the insulin resistance that and the amount of sugar that we're intaking now, it's really changing hormonal profiles. And so that's where it comes down to. It's not so much about the calories related to obesity. It's specifically sugar. And I really think that education alone isn't sufficient because you know, part of our culture is influenced by companies and what products are available to us. So I guess my comment is I don't think, I mean, you can educate people through the end of the day, and our behavior is not dictated only by our deep-seated beliefs. It's much more what we're exposed to and what's available to us.
I agree with you.
I completely agree. Education is a start. It's certainly not a finish. You know, and at the same time, you can have a normal weight person who's simply over fat, and their metabolic profile is going to be distorted. So the idea of looking at just weight, no. That's why physical activity is so important. It's because it does change body composition.
And Leaf writes in and asks, does the type of sugar matter? White sugar, maple sugar, honey? Can you specify the differences? Another person writes in to ask, is it healthy to substitute stevia? Something that I can't pronounce, X-Y-L-I-T-O-L. So can you answer that, Robert?
Short answer, calorie for calorie, ounce for ounce, gram for gram, they're all the same. Dr. Ayoub said something earlier about fruit and fruit juice. I want to make it very clear that there's data that shows that fruit is actually protective against diabetes, whereas fruit juice is causative. So, you know, it's not the same, and there are reasons why it's not the same, and the reason is, I can sum up in one word, it's called fiber. The bottom line
I'm not disagreeing with you there.
The reason that that sugar in fruit is okay is because of the inherent fiber that comes with it, which delays the absorption and gives your liver a chance to catch up, so it doesn't turn that extra fructose into liver fat. Now, with respect to diet sweeteners, this is a question everyone wants the answer to, including me. We don't have it. The data don't exist, and I'll try to make it very clear why we don't have it. There's something called pharmacokinetics, and there's something called pharmacodynamics. They are not the same. Pharmacokinetics is what your body does to a drug. Pharmacodynamics is what a drug does to your body. We have all the pharmacokinetics for all the diet sweeteners because the FDA demands it. It's in their charter. The Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938 says you are charged with assessing acute toxicity, whether you keel over and die. And that's pharmacokinetics. The problem is they don't mandate looking at pharmacodynamics. So they don't ask for those data. And the food industry says, well, why should we do those studies if the FDA doesn't ask for it? They're expensive, they take a long time, and they can't help our sales. We're not going to do them. And then we have an NIH who says, hey, that's the food industry's compound. They're making money off it. Let them do it.
I want to get to more.
No data.
So what about honey? Is that a good substitute for sugar?
Same.
It's the same, even though it's naturally...
It's even though it's natural, the bottom line is that because it has its own unique flavor and it's more expensive, people tend to use less of it. And anything that you use less of, as far as I'm concerned, that's better.
And we're going to go to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Welcome to your call, Ruth Ann.
Hi there. Thank you so much. This is a tad off topic, but what I had learned in terms of, it's not sugar, but it's... health control from a dear friend who has diabetes, and I was commenting about, oh, you know, chocolate wouldn't be a good thing to give you for a present. And she said sugar is not as big a problem for her with diabetes as refined carbohydrates.
So this is the concept of glycemic index, the idea of how high your blood glucose rises with a specific meal. Indeed, refined carbohydrate has a high glycemic index and will raise your blood glucose. And fructose has a low glycemic index. And the reason is because it's not glucose, it's fructose. When you consume fructose, you don't raise your blood glucose, you raise your blood fructose, which is 7 times worse for you. It's just not captured in the concept of glycemic index. And the concept of glycemic index is supported by the American Diabetes Association and actually eschewed by the American Heart Association. So we have some issues regarding what different medical societies think about all of this.
You can also, I should say that when you're talking with diabetes, I mean, a good way to blunt rises in blood sugar or blood glucose or blood fructose is to have a mixed meal with plenty of fiber and even some fat in there, and that will help slow the absorption of the glucose and the fructose. So there are ways to deal with this.
I agree. That's
always
real
about
food.
Just always about the absolute food that you're eating, because you're not usually having it on an empty stomach or in a large quantity. If you have it with a certain amount of protein and fat, that really does blunt a lot of the rises in blood sugar and blood fructose.
And that's Keith Thomas Ayoub. He's an associate clinical professor at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. We're also joined by Robert Lustig, who's a medical doctor and professor of pediatrics at UCSF. And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Benton from San Francisco writes in, a few years ago, my doctor pointed me to Dr. Lustig's YouTube video. I tried to go off sugar cold turkey, but I couldn't do it. That convinced me it's addictive. It took about a year to gradually eliminate sugar. It's been a couple years now. My body continues to improve. Less fat every day with little change in activity. My health is improving in every way. Thank you for that, Benton. And let's go to Greg in Mill Valley. Welcome to your call, Greg. Hi,
hello.
Greg. Yeah, you're on the air?
Yeah, it's in Palo Alto, but that's okay.
Well, welcome from Palo Alto, Greg.
Okay. I have a question about a book that I recently read called Primal Body, Primal Mind, written by a nutritionist. A very extensive book, seemingly well-researched. Her claim is that carbohydrates, once they're eaten, grains, even cooked grains, turn to sugar in the body. And her theory is that sugar is sugar. It doesn't matter what source it is. It's not good for you. And therefore, you should try to eliminate those sources, even the conversion sources of carbohydrates to sugar. I'd love to hear what your people have to say, your panelists have to say about this concept.
Great. Thanks, Greg. I'd love to hear it, too. Let's hear first from Keith Thomas.
I'll tell you, your body needs carbohydrates, win, lose, or draw. So the idea of thinking that carbohydrates are bad food, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous. So it's not a matter of yes, no, it's or good or bad. It's a matter of how much and how often and in what combinations. So the idea of having to forego, and I've met people like this who think that carbohydrates are just, you know, evil food, that has got to go. That you're going to throw away a lot of nutrition and a lot of really essential nutrition unless you include carbohydrates. Now, what people are missing from their diets primarily is fruit, vegetables, whole grain, and low-fat and fat-free dairy foods. Those are things that most people are missing, and that's one of the reasons they have such deficient diets. Now, if we clean up this part of our diet, we're going to go a long way towards getting a better diet and having less room for sugar and less room for excess. We really shouldn't have more than about 10-12% of added sugar and added fats, according to even U.S. dietary guidelines. But that doesn't give you a whole lot to spend on frills, like, you know, sugar and added fats and things. That creates a pretty prudent diet. Most people are not getting there. So I think if we concentrate on getting there and really focus on those foods, we will have a much more balanced American diet and a much healthier America. Also, including the physical activity, can't be healthy without it.
And I'm suspecting that, Robert, you would agree with that. More fruits, vegetables, fewer processed foods.
Oh, I agree with fruits, vegetables, and fewer processed foods, but I completely disagree with Dr. Ayoub on two points that he just made. One is that we need carbohydrates. We do not need carbohydrates. We can metabolize carbohydrates. There are things that come with natural carbohydrate, for instance, vitamins that come in the fiber fraction, for instance, the rice bran has vitamin B1, so there are certainly things you can get when you consume unrefined carbohydrates, but you do not need refined carbohydrates. Your body will make glucose.
Nobody's talking about refined carbohydrate.
You do need glucose, but your body will make it. There are only four things you actually need in order to survive. You need essential amino acids. You can make the rest. You need essential fatty acids. You can make the rest. You need vitamins and you need minerals. You do not need carbohydrate per se to come from diet. You do need carbohydrate. You need glucose in order to silylate proteins. And, of course, every cell in the body can run on glucose, but your liver can make it when it's needed. So the concept that you need carbohydrate is actually not correct, not true, and I would disagree with Dr. Ayoub completely. The other thing he said was fat-free. We do not need fat-free. In fact, fat-free is how we got into this mess. Fat-free is a terrible idea. Fat-free, as far as I'm concerned, if it says fat-free or even low-fat, might as well have a skull and crossbones on it. And the reason is because there are seven kinds of fat. If you're going fat-free, you're missing the essential fats that you actually need in order to make your mitochondria work properly.
Excuse me, but I need to weigh in here. First of all, if you're talking fat-free, there are plenty of whole foods that are fat-free, so let's be realistic here. Secondly, I hope you're not advocating a carbohydrate-free diet just because someone can survive on it, because that's going to put people into ketosis, and I really don't think you want to go there.
Well,
I don't want to go there.
I'll tell you where we do want to go. We want to go to more calls, gentlemen. Let's go to Margaret in Monterey County. Hi, Margaret. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. What a discussion. You know, and listening to this discussion, it just tells me that much more how complex this is, you have two people on who can't agree, seem to argue over every little point, and so if they're going to do that, which is fine, you know, it's informative, confusing, it can make your head spin, then that proves alone that education in itself is non-sufficient. I do believe that we should have some regulation. You know, when you look at the, I served on a high school board, and I can tell you that we had people on our staff who were confused with current regulations that were coming through. And these are the people that are serving our students, their food. There is a lot of sugar out there in processed food. It's out there. And in order for the average person to try to educate themselves on what is right, what is wrong, is it calorie good for you? It is not good for you. All of these things, it's too much, and the population is we're overwhelmed. And I would also say that the food industry in themselves would push back, because what they have done is they have completely gone out of their way to manipulate information, to deceive the public, to make you think that you're only getting so many calories and you're not getting an overdose, which I think is what the main problem comes down to, is that the American public is getting overdosed on toxic sugars. And I have, living in the area that I do with a lot of student population that attend the schools, there are students whose families are farm workers. I come from a farm worker family, and I can tell you that the exercise, which is absolutely necessary, but you can't, you know, it's necessary, but it isn't enough, because we have people that are thin that are getting too much sugar, and we have people that work in the field that should be thin that are overweight.
All right, Margaret, I'm going to throw that to our guest. Thank you so much, and let's go to Robert.
Amen, sister. I couldn't have said it better. Do you want a job?
But can you talk about the effects on children and teens? Is it different for them? Does sugar affect them differently? Or is it just that you get accustomed to that taste at an early age and want more?
That's a very good question. We don't have the answer to that yet. We're doing the studies to try to answer that as we speak, whether or not kids are particularly susceptible. Here's what I would say, and it goes to a point that Dr. Ayoub made earlier. He wants to start with physical activity in schools and altering nutritional guidelines in schools, and that's great, and I am totally for that. There's nothing that Dr. Ayoub is for that I'm not for. It's just a question of how much more you need to do. Here's the problem. We have an epidemic of obese newborns. Newborns. Four studies, South Africa, Israel, Russia, United States, birth weight is up 200 grams, that's a half a pound, in every single one of those countries over the past 25 years. And when you do DEXA scanning on those to determine body composition, it turns out that those 200 grams are all fat. So we are now seeing an epidemic of obese newborns. And let me tell you, when you make fat cells, they like to get filled.
So we're almost out of time, gentlemen. Can we focus together on solutions in the remaining couple minutes in the program? You wanted to get something
in here?
Yes. On solutions only. That's all I want to hear about right now.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you. I think for the average person listening here, they have a few things to understand. First of all, yes, we do eat too much sugar. And yes, there are options and solutions right in the supermarket that people can do to cut back on their sugar. I would concentrate, if I had somebody in my office right now, as I will in a few minutes, I would tell them, look, concentrate on the beverages that you're drinking, cut back, drink more water. The beverages are where most people are getting their sugar, okay, the vast majority. Also, cut back on the added sweets, desserts, etc. That's all most people need to understand about cutting back on sugar and replace those foods with extra fruits, extra vegetables, extra low-fat and fat-free dairy foods, because those are the things that most people's diets are missing.
Okay, and so that's focusing on what you can do personally. Robert, let me give you 1 minute to tell us, what do you think as consumers we might do politically?
Is if you cut out the sodas and you cut out the ice cream, you would still be over the American Heart Association limit for added sugar in your diet.
But you agree that that's
more.
A good thing to do.
Oh, of course,
so what
absolutely.
More, in 1 minute, what right. more do you want to be done?
Okay, what we need is a new food business model. The food industry makes their money on quantity, not quality. Once upon a time, they made their money on quality, not quantity, and that changed in the early 1970s because Richard Nixon basically wanted to make food cheap because fluctuating food prices cause political unrest. The food industry doesn't care what they sell. They just want to sell. If we change the food business model to reward them for quality over quantity, they would sell the right stuff instead of the wrong stuff. And they've told me that they would do that if it paid for them to do it.
So move the subsidies to that? You could.
It's changing subsidies. It's changing the entire food distribution system toward real food by sourcing it locally. That would improve sustainability. That would basically change the entire food context that we have here in the United States. It would make things much better. But the problem is, it's going to take a generation to do it. We got to start now.
Thank you so much, Dr. Robert Lustig is professor of pediatrics at UCSF. We're also joined by Keith Thomas Ayoub, who's associate professor of clinical department of pediatrics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And I know that there's a lot more to say about this. You can post comments at our website. You can put resources there. You can find out more about our guests, including Dr. Lustig's YouTube video, TED Talk on sugar. And thanks to everybody who emailed and called. And I apologize that we couldn't get to everybody. I know that you had a lot to say about this. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. On the next Year Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of President Obama's proposal to end the NSA's bulk data collection. We'll also talk about the Koch brothers' funding of public colleges and the death sentence in Egypt for more than 500 members of the Muslim Brotherhood. We'll be joined by the Center for Public Integrity's Dave Leventhal, Freedom of the Press Foundation's Trevor Tim, and McClatchy's Nancy Yousaf, who'll join us from Cairo. Join the conversation on the next Year Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.